Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
It has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big step!
Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at hardworkprocessing.com. I am Jason Mann. With me as usual is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be with you.
Yeah, we got a very current but historical game to talk about here. It's the talk of the basketball and NBA universe, and well worth it. It was an incredible Game 7. That's what we're, of course, talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. The 2016 NBA Finals Game 7 between the Golden State Warriors, Cleveland Cavaliers. Cleveland pulling off the amazing upset coming back from being down 3-1 for the first time in the NBA Finals, only the fourth time in 19 Game 7s in the Finals, which the road team was able to pull off the upset. So all the amazing, crazy things that you could possibly imagine, the Cavs overcame, beating the 73-win greatest regular season team of all time, at least in terms of wins. Maybe the greatest upset in NBA Finals history, probably. We'll talk about a little bit more about that and, you know, kind of get into some of the history that was made, but no question it was absolutely really fun, amazing game, a really big game in terms of what it kind of meant for what we're going to think of the Cavs and the Warriors going forward. Of course, that's always subject to change based on, you know, what happens next year and in seasons ahead of now. But, you know, we can definitely say that it's, you know, quite earth shaking in terms of, you know, what we kind of thought going in before the series and what we think now. And it definitely worth some consideration, even though obviously it happened recently. But I think we're going to talk about it within, just kind of put it in historical context, talk about some other things that were similar and were different, and just try to have a little bit of fun, talk about some basketball. So.
Absolutely. And even if, you know, and one thing I do want to mention before we move on is that even if, you know, you and I were obviously basketball nerds, we love basketball, we adore it. You know, a lot of people listening to this, you guys are, you know, huge basketball fans, that sort of stuff. But it was actually from the public conscience, too. This game was also, I mean, I believe I saw the figure that it was the highest rated one since game 6 of 98, which, you know, of course, the Michael Jordan Utah Jazz, you know, the Michael Jordan shot his final game, that sort of stuff. I mean, that we're talking about a lot of games, a lot of years, a lot of stuff. And this is the one that really just it seemed to grab the public conscience. I know there were people I'm a huge wrestling fan or whatever. And you are as well. I was covering Money in the Bank that night, which was, WWF pay-per-view that night. And I had friends that were saying that would show up anytime to watch wrestling. They were always watching wrestling. They don't care about, you know, the basketball or whatever. Oh, no, I'm not going to be there. I'm going to watch basketball. I'm like, you know, you guys don't even like basketball. But like, it mattered that I had my mom say, oh, what time is the game on? And like, you know what I mean? Like, and she doesn't really care all that much, but it's just there was something about the public conscience of it being a game seven, of it being LeBron, of it being Steph Curry, of it being all these different things that we talk about coming into it. And then the game doesn't disappoint either, which is the other really awesome part about it, is that we could have all went, oh man, I can't wait for this game, and then, you know, the Warriors win by 30 and it's like, oh well, that's no fun. But it wasn't that. It was down to the final minutes, and there's these stunning plays too that happened in the last few minutes as well that just really just add to the whole storybook thing of it. Like, of course, the LeBron dunk, the LeBron missed, or the LeBron block, I meant to say, but the missed dunk that LeBron had too, that was one that, like, man, if he hits that, can you just imagine, like, how much is at stake with just, like, LeBron dunking over Draymond Green to basically seal the game for the Cavs, like just a monstrous dunk after just of all this stuff happening. Like that would have just been an incredible, incredible moment. But this game wasn't short on those moments regardless.
Yeah, and even that moment, I mean, even what happened, him not getting the dunk, but getting fouled, falling on the ground, looking like he really injured his wrist, but, you know, dusting himself off. He missed the first free throw, but he got the second one, which basically clinched the game. That was pretty incredible what happened too. But you're right, obviously, if he had actually landed that dunk, it would have been just, it would have
blown. I mean, play gets replayed. Yeah, that play gets replayed like 40 million times in our life.
Of course, he did that amazing block right before then, which is I think going to be the iconic moment of this game, although there were several very good ones as well. So yeah, lots of great stuff. Lots of really, it's really why we watch basketball, for this kind of great classic game, memorable moments, between, basically the two biggest stars in the league and two most important teams in the league for the season. It was a big surprise who won, just because of what the Warriors did this season. But that's also why they play the game, because sometimes it happens in a way you don't expect.
Absolutely.
We did a series last year. We went through every game 7 in NBA Finals history, all 18 of them previous to this, and we kind of rated them as the greatest of all time. If we're rethinking that, I'm not necessarily, we don't have to put a number on it, though you can if you want to, but where are we kind of?
No, Jason, we need to define it right now. Like, you answer this question definitively. You do not dance around it. This is not what you do in 2016.
There you go. Analysis. Well, I'm sorry.
Rank every single one of them. right now.
So we did kind of put them in order before. We had I'll just go through like the top four were the Spurs and Heat in 2013 was number four. Number three was the Celtics and Lakers from 1962, which went into overtime. That was the Frank Selvey missed the famous shot at the end, and then Celtics were able to carry it from there. Number two was the Celtics and Hawks from 1957, which was the double overtime game with the famous final play of the Hawks throwing a cross-court pass, hitting it off the backboard, and Bob Pettit barely being able to just missing the tip in. And then number one being the Lakers and Pistons in 88 with, just crazy back and forth. The Pistons almost coming up with a dramatic rally, but it falling just short. And then the famous final scene of the fans rushing as the Pistons are inbounding it. And then Isaiah crashing into Magic Johnson to end it. And, so a lot of dramatic ones in there as well. There's obviously one of the more famous games of all time from 84 with the first Magic and Bird duel for the first series for them and that going to game 7, so some other great ones as well. Where are you kind of thinking this? Is it in that top 5? Is it clear somewhere for you? Where are you kind of thinking?
I would definitely put it in that top 5. Like, again, I was just joking about the ranking thing. I have an impossible task. Like, I hate ranking things like that. Like, because I would change it like 3,000 times. You'd ask me tomorrow and I completely changed my top 5. But definitely in that top 5, I think. My initial thought of recent vintage, as far as like games that I've watched or game 7s, NBA Finals game 7s that I've watched, it really, it's hard to argue with this one being, among the best, if not the best. I mean, you have, of course, 84, like you said, 88, which are both really fantastic games. It's right up there. It has to be just neck and neck with those. Again, it's really hard to choose those. But when you talk about how much stake there was in this game as well, I think that's what really adds a little bit more for me. I mean, of course, you had Magic Bird in two historic franchises in 84, so that sort of helps there. 88, of course, you have the really close game. You have the Pistons, kind of a budding dynasty.
Yeah.
And, of course, Magic and the Lakers still doing their thing. So those had just arguably about as many stakes, but I mean, we're talking about just a guy in LeBron really defining his entire career path. For a lot of people, this was like seeing what the narrative is surrounding him after that game compared to what it was maybe, a week prior or 2 weeks prior. I mean, that's for a guy like LeBron, you can't say a superstar making performance, but maybe like a legendary all-time great making performance, even though I don't think it necessarily needed that. I think he was already kind of there, but for some people it was. Hey, he did this without Miami. He did this without Wade. He kind of did it on his own, and the comeback, and it's in Cleveland. And there's just a lot there that it's a sort of unpack.
Yeah, I mean, it's an added boost to that argument. There's no question about it. I mean, I think that's this is another huge thing on his resume. He already had great things, and obviously his career stands up with just about anyone. But I think it is sort of a final shut up to the critics of LeBron, who, you know, the silly people who still want to, you know, kind of nitpick at everyone at the things that he does and don't, you know, appreciate the greatness that we've had. You know, we've gone on about that, how people do that. I think there's just any like question about, you know, clutchness or anything like that. Hopefully, yeah. I mean, you never know. Yeah. Again, you know, there's, I think there'll be less of it. I doubt it will go away, of course, but, you know, which is fine. Yeah. For me, it's standing in terms of like star power and what the results mean in terms of history. It's really up there, I think, with 69 and 84. 69, of course, we've talked about it many times during the WrestleMania podcast, with it being Bill Russell's last stand with the Celtics, and the Will Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West Lakers falling just short, you know, as Wilt is leaves the game and his coach refuses to put him back in, and the Lakers try to rally but fall short, Don Nelson having that that crazy lucky bounce on his jumper to basically seal it. So a lot of great things there. 84 didn't have that one dramatic moment, but it was just it was kind of a rising out of the ashes moment for the NBA with this rivalry finally coming to a head after five years after their big a championship game in the NCAA finals and where the league was going to, you know, take off from there. And also I think it was similar to the 2013 finals, the Heat and the Spurs, another, of course, you know, great LeBron moment where he really stepped up and hit some big shots. And, in terms of being like competitive and intense throughout, but not, you know, sort of being an ugly, not a completely ugly game, but just definitely like a game where you could tell the nerves were being felt, a game where it was slowed down. It wasn't the most beautiful basketball in the world, but it was so intense. And, you know, even though I didn't have a strong rooting interest, I was slightly rooting for the Cavs. I mean, I know I'm from Ohio, so I have more Cavs people in my life. I was happy for them to do it and happy for LeBron, and obviously looking for Cleveland to break that championship streak. So I was pulling for them. But if the Warriors had won, I would have been totally fine with it. But I was, you know, my nerves were just, just the excitement of the game and just the intensity of the game really brought that out in me.
Yeah, and of, you know, I was kind of going through some of the recent games and thinking about that as well. Of course, it was 94, which was a super close and pretty fun game, you know, with Ewing trying to win it for New York and Houston sort of emerging as a post-Jordan, you know, team, you know, franchise that has a chance to win a title. So there's fun in that one. But I don't know. I don't know if it matches up with this guy just because the game itself wasn't as good. You know, we've seen some clips and I've seen the full game of that. I remember watching it and going back on YouTube and stuff and watching it. And it's fine. It's okay. But like, it doesn't match this game, I don't think. And then, you know, 2013, like you mentioned, the Heat Spurs, a very good game as well. I remember that being a very emotional, very, you know, but still, I just feel like this one's got a little bit more. And then 2005 was just like 81 to 74 with the Pistons and the Spurs. And it's like the, you know, that era of basketball or whatever, which was still a fine game. It was fun, but yeah, it's like that was just like, it's really like not a very good game. So it's like, it was kind of close and it's like the big deal, but it's like, I don't know. Like, I just remember hating that game when it was over. I was just like, ah, God, good, go away.
Yeah, like, the 2010 one as well with the another ugly, although another intense game, but more ugly than this one, certainly the Lakers and Celtics in 2010 as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do want to kind of defend the overall series a little bit because I feel like there was a lot of like, this was a really bad series other than Game 7 out there. And yeah, I mean, it was the first series, I believe, that each had a margin of greater than 10 points in the end result. But I did feel like I was regularly watching, you know, basketball that was pretty fascinating. You know, when Cleveland was taking it to Golden State in games three and in game six, I really did think like, you know, wow, like Cleveland's really, am I really, you know, is what I'm seeing true? Like, can I believe this? Like, I just feel like it was like a, you know, one side was getting a huge flurry and putting the other side on the ropes. And then, you know, Golden State would come back and respond and they had big games. And I didn't feel like it was boring, especially after the first two games. Like the first two games, it felt a little dispiriting and it felt like Cleveland didn't have much of a chance. Then Cleveland came and thrashed them in game three. And after that, I felt like it was, you know, it was reasonably close, or, you know, throughout the most of those games, even while there were large margins at play, it still, there were entertaining and fascinating things to kind of watch as it was going on. It helped that the crowds for both sides were really amazing and that they were pretty engaged. It was mostly home teams winning up to those big margins. I feel like when you're watching home teams, you know, playing really well, you're going to get those crowds to be really excited, and that's going to add some entertainment value, even if it's not necessarily that competitive of a game.
Yeah, and I think even with those blowouts, I think you made a good point about those, and I enjoyed some of the blowouts and some of the, you know, large deficits, because you saw, like, adjustments being made, and, like, on a game-to-game level, it was like, all right, well, this is what we need to do to, you know, and then, like, you saw, you know, of course, the big Cleveland games were like, oh my god, Kyrie Irving is, like, emerging as, like, a peak Allen Iverson-esque player. Like, this is pretty cool. Like, even if they are winning and pulling away, and you got LeBron, you know, dropping 40, and, you know, LeBron and Kyrie putting 40 in together. So, like, you saw these different things. I pretty much agree that since, you know, yeah, those first few games where Golden State was just kind of pulling away and you were basically like, oh, geez, Cleveland has no chance. And oh, my God, they're just going to get thrashed here. And then it's more, you know, more interest was in, OK, what do they do in the offseason? Do they trade Kevin Love, or do you get rid of Kyrie Irving, or what do you do? Or is LeBron leaving? You know, that was the intrigue of the first few games. But basically, since it got to 3-1 and basically since Cleveland started showing some life at that point, I really was fascinated by everything, because it was like, OK, you have to watch every game because you never know. You know, one more game and Golden State wins. Like, that's all there is to it. So you have to be enthralled. And the thing with it as well is that even if the Cavs are up 15, I never at any point thought, okay, Golden State's dead, because it's Golden State. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like, we saw them against Oklahoma City. It's like, oh, well, they're dead and buried. Oh, wait, in 5 minutes they can score, you know, 15 points. Like, that's not hard for that team to do. So I really was never, there was never a point where I said, oh, well, this game's toast, forget it. Because it's like, well, no, Steph Curry hits three threes in a row, and then they're right back in this thing. So you never, it might be a result of that team being the way they are and how quickly they can acquire points and how quickly they can score on you and how quickly their runs can happen, that I never really, the blowouts weren't really boring for me. It wasn't just like, okay, well, they're just going to slow it down and it's over now. It was like, no, it's Golden State, man. They can come back in a blink of an eye. So I was always intrigued, even if their deficit was pretty high in some of the games.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it, you know, according to Basketball Reference, it was actually the fifth closest NBA Finals ever in terms of a cumulative point differential, which is interesting. I mean, yeah, but it was tied in the score through game six. And then game seven was 4-point margin. So it was obviously ended up being a close series in that respect, even if the individual games other than game seven were not close. But so, you know, looking at where some of the your performances in game seven rank among all times, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, so I went using the game score metric that Basketball Reference has. Of course, this is only since 1984, so it's a relatively small sample size, but still, we have a good little amount of games in here. But I thought what was striking to me is the best Finals Game 7 game score of all time, 35.9, is owned by Draymond Green, who had 32 points, 15 rebounds, 9 assists on 11 of 15 shooting, 5 of 7 from 3. I think we kind of forget. Like, I knew he was having a great game, of course, because in the first half he was the big part of the Warriors. But then when it was all said and done, like, I completely forgot that, oh my God, Draymond had like a historically great game in this. And game scored pretty much just says, yeah, it is the best, you know, since 1984, of course, when the metric will go back to the best game seven game score of all time. Yeah, almost had the fourth game seven triple double or game seven triple double as well. So it's just it's really fascinating that Draymond was that way. LeBron, he's fifth all time in terms of game seven game scores at 23.1. Kyrie Irving is 20th all time, and Kevin Love 35th, even though he only had 9 points and 14 rebounds, but still a pretty solid game all around. Yeah. So that's four guys right there in, you know, that top 50 of all time game scores for game sevens. Of course, relatively small sample size, but still pretty significant. And Draymond being the highest is definitely a fascinating fact as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really going to be interesting because, of course, the series really turned around when Draymond was suspended for game five of the series, in that, you know, the cat, you know, LeBron and Kyrie both scoring 41 points in that game and, you know, giving the Cavs life, and they ended up going from there. but then he, of course, he's really the warrior who delivered in this series. So in game seven. So it's, you know, he almost had a chance to redeem himself to a certain extent, if he needed redeeming, which is another question. But it didn't quite work out, even though, again, he had, you know, at least by this measurement, the best finals game seven of all time. And certainly, you know, 32 points, 15 rebounds, 9 assists. He's going to be on that list, you know, even though he did most of it in the first half. In the second half, he was quieter. But, you know, he's obviously one of the great defenders, too, even though it was hard for to stop LeBron James. Although, you know, for game seven, LeBron wasn't particularly efficient, even though he got his numbers and obviously played really well. But, I think that's really interesting that, that Draymond was able to on one level be so great, and then the other level, of course, have a large amount of responsibility for his team, failing to win the series.
Absolutely. And then points, I did this as well from Basketball Reference. This is since 1964. So this is the most points in a game seven. So we have a little bit bigger of a data set. Draymond's 32 is sixth all time. LeBron, he's 11th all time with his 27. Kyrie Irving is 14th all time with his 26. And then Steph Curry is 55th all time. So Draymond, again, right in that, top 10 of all time game seven scoring outputs, which, like you said, of course, it being mostly in the first half, too, is also a remarkable achievement for him, and just a really cool thing that's kind of getting overlooked a little bit in the hysteria, rightfully so, of, you know, the Cavs winning the series and the championship for Cleveland. But Draymond, don't forget about his awesome game. So
yeah, and if you look at where LeBron ranks among the best finals MVPs during the series, so he had 29.7 points, 11.3 rebounds, 8.9 assists, 2.6 steals, and 2.3 blocks. Famously, he finished for the first time leading the finals or any playoff series, I believe, in points, rebounds, assists, steals, and blocks. So the only guy to ever do that. His points were the 12th most for a finals MVP. Jordan had 41 in 1993 for number one. And this is going back to 1969, the first year that there was a finals MVP. Rebounds were the 14th ever. Wilt had 23.2 in 1972. He's the second among forwards on that list to Larry Bird in 84. He had 14. He had the fourth most assists ever. Magic had 13, averaged 13 in 1987. The sixth most steals ever. Rick Barry had 3.5 in 1975. And the seventh most blocks ever. Duncan had 5.3 blocks in 2003. He was the third player to record a triple-double in the Game 7 of the Finals, joining Jerry West in 1969 and James Worthy in 1988. As we mentioned, Draymond almost joined that club. Not quite. But remarkable performance. Obviously, and it's hard to kind of judge the everyone in terms of a finals MVP, but it is certainly among the best finals that I've ever seen from one player. Especially, we're going to get into it a little bit further down, but games five and six, his performances there are just like incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, it's his playoff line as well, and his finals line is just incredible. I mean, is you know, finals line 29.7 points per game, 11.3 rebounds per game, 8.9 assists per game, 26.5 game score throughout the entire finals. I did just kind of for a little fun. I said that's a pretty good line. Let's see how many seasons are comparable to that. How many guys had seasons that are even remotely comparable? That's the 29 points per game, all that sort of stuff. 75 guys in history. Had seasons with comparable numbers to what LeBron did, but that's still, I mean, we're talking about in the NBA history, all those guys, and that's what LeBron did in the NBA Finals against the 73-win Golden State Warriors team. So it's just a really remarkable achievement for him.
Right, absolutely, yeah. And, he led the team back from 3-1, which had never happened in the finals before, against a team that had not dropped three straight since the fall of 2013. The Warriors lost 9 playoff games after they'd lost 9 regular season games, which, you know, is just remarkable. But for LeBron, I mean, obviously his finals record is now, it would have been 2-5. Now it's 3-4, which sounds a lot better. There was a 538 article, which I thought was interesting, on what LeBron's finals record should be. And really, to me, the one finals in which his team lost that really should have won, I think, was the Mavericks series in 2011. And even that really you know, wasn't that necessarily that huge of a there wasn't necessarily that as huge of a difference between those teams as people think. You know, the rest of the time, you know, basically the result, the favored team won the result. I mean, in 2007, his team had no chance. The Spurs, he carried a very not
Drew Gooden. When Drew Gooden's your second best player, like, that's probably not great. Or your second or third best player. Right. That's probably not ideal.
Yeah, it was not good. So 2007, he had no chance. 2011, you know, he should have won that series. But I think it was a performance kind of like what the Warriors did, where they kind of, the Warriors just kind of didn't really, they had the better talent, but just didn't have it just didn't seem to have the resolve, or weren't playing together. Weren't quite right in the same series. And
it took an all time great performances from multiple Mavericks as well. Yeah. I mean, you had Dirk playing out of his mind. You had Jason Kidd playing out of his mind. Like, you know, just a ton of guys, Tyson Chandler,
Sean Marion playing great defense. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there was multiple revelations that had to occur on the other side of the court to really make it. And it was still even a super close series. So yeah. And I agree. I think they're very high or a lot of contrast between this year's Warriors team and that Miami Heat team, so I definitely agree with that.
Right, and then 2012, 2013, his teams win. 2014, the Spurs killed the Heat, but LeBron played really well, which is everyone else didn't deliver in that series. 2015 with the Warriors, the fact that the Cavs went to six in that. I mean, he did about as much as he could. His efficiency was not good, but just his, he produced so much and had to take on such a high amount of role on offense. And so I think he did about as much as you could have expected of a player there. And then, this year he stepped up in some ways, was even better. I think the big difference was he was able to, when he started making some open jumpers in game five, that really, I think, turned things around. That changed how the Cavs were defended, and I think it just changed the tenor of the series.
Yeah, he was back to peak LeBron. I mean, that you talked about that Miami Heat series where there were no doubters and they were definitely the favorite teams. I mean, that was LeBron at that time. He was a no doubt super efficient player that could hit it from, 15, he could hit threes okay, and then would also just destroy you in the paint as well, like he's always wanted to do. So it was the return of peak LeBron and Kyrie morphing into a peak Allen Iverson as well. So it's a nice little 1-2 combo there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as far as Steph and the Warriors go, I mean, how do you feel it changes the 73 wins for you, that accomplishment, and how should people view it?
Yeah, how people should and how they will.
Right.
Me personally, yeah. it doesn't affect me one way or another. I think that's still a tremendous accomplishment. And I spent the entire weekend, of course, living in Chicago, having to say, hey, look, guys, that doesn't take anything away from the fact that they won 73 games in the regular season. You know, you can say all you want about, oh, well, they didn't win the rings, who cares? You know, the Bulls, yay. But they won more games than the Bulls in the regular season. Like, that's just a fact. So I think you can't take that away from them, that they were, you can still put them in the conversation as arguably, or not even arguably, the best regular season team in history. I think that remains. Of course, people are going to look at it because they didn't win the ring, that season's a disappointment. And to a fact, it maybe is. And maybe we then look at this, and maybe other teams look at this as an example of, and I don't know if this is exactly fact, I don't know if what the reasons were, but maybe other teams look at this and go, hey, this team went all out to capture this record. That's what they wanted to do. They mentioned at the beginning of the season that's something they wanted to do. They killed themselves to get to this record, get to 73, but ultimately, if you don't win the championship, those guys go home disappointed. Everybody's a little disappointed, even though they had that accomplishment. So it's a thing where maybe you look at and go, at some point, maybe it would have been a good idea for them to just say, hey, let's take our foot off the pedal, let's get healthy, let's do that sort of stuff. But there's a lot of stuff that happened in the playoffs as well that just I don't know if you can say is a direct relation or correlation between going for those 73. There were little injuries that happened. There was Steph Curry slipping on a wet spot or whatever. Like, things happen, like that happened. So to me, part of me wants to say, oh, them going for 73 is the reason why they sort of seem to slow down in this finals and slow down this playoffs. But I mean, they still made it to seven games in the NBA finals, so they didn't slow all that much. But then a part of me also like says, again, you know, they made it to the game seven of the NBA Finals. They made it all the way here. They made a miraculous comeback against, you know, Oklahoma City. And if not for just a few little fluke injuries here and there, Andre Iguodala's back acting up, you know, Andrew Bogut, his problem, and Steph Curry, who never looked 100% through the entire series, really. Those are kind of just fluky things that happen as well. So, I mean, for me, it's not going to change what I think of that 73 wins. I think that's still a tremendous accomplishment. But there will be talk about, hey, you know, was that the right plan if the goal was to win an NBA championship? Should you have gone for that 73 if you really wanted to win the title? I don't know if that's entirely fair, though.
Yeah, I admire the audacity of going for 73. And, you know, that's like, you know, an amazing accomplishment. It, obviously, not winning the title, I think, just changed, like, it makes that it's still impressive, but it makes that less like exciting because, you know, the end result was different than they wanted. I mean, yeah, obviously, I'm sure that they're disappointed about it, and they, you know, might think that, hey, you know, maybe if we took it a little bit easier in the season, we would have had more energy for the playoffs. And who knows whether that's true or not. You know, I do think that it's interesting how they are viewed. I feel like the conversation around them has changed a bit. And there's always been some critics of like kind of the style they play and feeling like it doesn't last and feeling like they, you know, that they just don't play in a way that people feel like has lasting power, which I don't agree with. But I think there's just some threat of, you know, that this team threatens the status quo in a way that makes people uncomfortable. I mean, it's similar to, I think, you know, the stuff that we've read about how, you know, what was written about, you know, big guys like Russell and Chamberlain when they, you know, first came into the league. It's like, oh, these giant guys are going to ruin the game. And
right, pass the ball more. Right. The game is predicated on passing, not scoring.
Or the idea of don't jump, you know, don't take jump shots. Because, I feel like it's a little bit of that. I mean, I understand where some of these people are coming from. You know, I certainly don't want everyone to play the same way. A team that plays in the most analytics friendly way, like Houston with taking a lot of threes and shooting at the rim, they're not the most fun team to watch. So I think it can lead to basketball that isn't fun to watch. But the Warriors, you know, for the most part, I mean, they're incredibly fun to watch and they share the ball and they. Yes. And they went away from some of those things, honestly, during the finals, whether that was just, just the Cavs made it hard for them to do so. The injuries played effect, you know, guys lost confidence, what have you. You know, they really became more of a jump shooting. Nate Duncan made this point that they really became, you know, kind of the team that people criticized them for. They were this more of this jump shooting team and they weren't getting to the rim and they weren't kind of doing the, you know, the things that were hard for them.
Yeah. Oh, the final few minutes was Steph just kind of dribbling and then taking a shot when the guy was in it. It's like, right. Oh, okay. Yeah. Like, that's not really how you guys played. Yeah. Like, you know that, right?
He can do that. I mean, obviously he can make those incredible shots from incredible distances and can get them off in, you know, in a very, very small amount of space. So that's, you know, one of the things that makes him incredibly great. But yes, they usually do that after like ball movement and after running, and, you know, they don't necessarily ISO so much and just, you know, kind of let him work. I mean, you know, some of that was on switches on big men, and usually he can totally beat those guys, and he wasn't doing that as much, you know, after the injury, which, you know, like I said, most people will, yeah, I mean, I think you can say, like, you know, there was this injury and it can just be, you know, part of what happened. It's not necessarily an excuse. Like, the Cavs earned their victory and they should be proud of it. And, you know, but, you know, it was a thing that existed. But, you know, one thing for me that this kind of leads to is that it's obviously going to change people's how they feel about Steph, how they felt about his season, which is one of the great offensive seasons of all time. He earned the MVP, and I think he was right for him to be the unanimous MVP. There was no other really strong choice to me. But there is, you know, I do wonder if if any like slip in health and athleticism affects him more than it might affect other elite players because of just the narrow windows in which he's able to, you know, get an advantage of somebody, get a shot off on somebody. If it's just a tiny bit less and those windows close, you know, is he going to decline quicker than a lot of elite players do? I mean, I guess the question is, how long can he sustain that level of greatness? And is it realistic to expect him to be that great next year? Is he going to drop down? You know, I think he's going to be a very good player for a very long time and a great player for a while. But I just wonder, like, if this if both kind of seeing him at not quite his superpowers, and also maybe what's happened in the last couple rounds of the playoffs with how teams have sort of dealt with him, is this going to change, you know, how he performs going forward and how people deal with him going forward?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you can definitely see some case there, because that was something that, you know, privately, I think you and I have talked about and people have talked about is, you know, this guy, you know, he's able to get these shots off so quick, and he's able to just be lightning quick and all that sort of stuff. If he loses a step, even if it's a quarter of a step, a half a step, anything like that, what's going to happen? You know, is it going to be something where this guy now is just kind of an okay player, really still really good, but not quite the, you know, world beater that we've always seen? Like, I think everybody's kind of assumed that there was going to be somewhat of a shelf life on the world beater thing, but for me, it's not really fair to say quite yet, because God only knows if he comes back next year and he's just good, you know what I mean? Like, people are going to seem kind of silly and we're sort of reacting to these one little series or whatever, but I think we did see a little peek into the future of, hey, this is what could, you know, when he approaches 30 or whatever, when he passes 30, like, this could be the stuff that we're used to seeing, but it's still pretty damn good. You know, it's not, you know, a unanimous MVP, and that might be over and that peak might be over, but it's hard to, I mean, we might seem silly now if he comes back next year and has an even better season, you know what I mean? Like, so it's kind of hard to react on that, but I think it was an interesting little look into what a slower, less athletic, maybe a little tired Steph Curry does look like. But yeah, it's hard to really judge of what's going to happen in the future just based off, you know, this series or these playoffs alone.
Absolutely. So would you like to see part three Warriors and Cavs in the finals? Is that something that you think would be
I think for me it depends on what happens with Kevin Durant. If Kevin Durant comes back and maybe does a 1-year deal or something like that, or he does whatever it is, I really do want to see a Westbrook, a peak Westbrook, peak Durant versus LeBron Cavs. I think that I would really, really love to see.
Okay.
If possible. If, you know, something happened, or, you know, would it kill me to have this again? No, absolutely not, because it'd be a sweet little rubber match. Like, we're wrestling fans, you got to get the rematch, right? Like,
sure.
You got to do that. So, but yeah, part of me, I really want to see that peak Thunder team do it. But if, you know, Durant goes elsewhere or whatever he does or whatever happens with the Thunder, if that can't occur, I think this is the next best step for me. I really do want to see a Durant Westbrook versus the Cavs series, but I wouldn't be shedding any tears if we saw the rubber match between these two.
Yeah, absolutely not. And I think it would be enjoyable. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't mind something new too, because I don't like it when the same team always is doing the same thing. But I do think that overall, if we got a third matchup, I mean, that there would be some incredible history there. We've never had the same two teams in a finals matchup 3 years in a row, so that would be some neat history. But obviously, a lot of things are going to happen between now and then. I mean, I would think they would, both those teams would be favorites to win their conferences again and make it to the playoffs. But, you know, the Warriors came very close to losing to the Thunder, so you know, they'll be going after them. You never know with the Spurs, and, you know, some, and whatever happens in free agency may lead some of the teams to there's so many things that can happen. So,
absolutely.
All right. So, who is our favorite first time champion on the Cavs? The ring chasing veteran, for lack of a better term. I mean, Richard Jefferson, he certainly is the
yeah.
The fact that he contributed so much in this series is kind of wild, you know.
Mo Williams got playing time too. Who knew it? Like, all of a sudden out of nowhere, it's like, oh, Mo Williams, we're going to play him a lot. Like, that was, I think I got to go Jefferson though, especially with the, I'm going to retire now moment, you know, with the cigar ready to go and goes, you know what? Yeah, I think I'm done. I'm going to retire. I think I'm going to go Richard Jefferson with my pick.
Okay.
There's a few good ones, but I like, just cause, you know, I was watching that game with a few people that don't follow the NBA as closely as me. And they go, oh, my, like the first thing out of their mouths when, you know, he entered the game was, oh, my God, Richard Jefferson's still in the league. And I went, yeah, yeah. You'll see. He's pretty good still. Sure. Like, he's not that Richard Jefferson. He's not going to, like, get an alley-oop from Jason Kidd and throw it down. But he's a solid, dependable player at this point. So, no, I think I'm going to go with Richard Jefferson just because he's been so many different places and so many different things. And his career's had just so many different arcs as well. Because, like, this is not, like, this Richard Jefferson isn't even remotely close to the Richard Jefferson that we saw that entered the league. So I always like that when, like, those guys, like, I love, like, Vince Carter on Memphis, you know, on Memphis. That's, like, my favorite thing ever, that it's like slow old Vince that gets like blocked by the rim when he tries to dunk and just like shoots corner threes. Like that always fascinates me when that guys go from that to that or whatever. So I think I'm gonna go Jefferson.
Yes. I'm gonna go with Mo Williams. Just because, you know, he had the first time around in Cleveland and that didn't work out, and now he's, you know, and he's he had that crazy 52-point game with the Wolves, and that was last season, which is pretty amazing. And you know, he's come full circle, and again, I feel like with the on this team, it's been it's cool to have him be a part of it. He actually, you know, made some once Dellavedova became unplayable, he suddenly became a guy who could contribute. So that was nice.
Yeah,
you know, he did some good stuff.
And Mo, I think that's a really good point that you brought up. I mean, Mo Williams is the second best player on what I think would have been that Cavs team that would have just steamrolled into the NBA Finals that one year. You know, of course, they got upset by Orlando. I'm blanking on the year. I think 2008 or 2009, right? 2009, I think, was the year. I'm blanking on the year or whatever. That was that Cavs team that was just, they won, you know, 60-plus games. They had swept everybody. And then they got to Orlando and it was like, ah, crap. Like, we have no answer for Rashard Lewis, no answer for Hedo Turkoglu. And they got upset. And of course, Orlando goes to the Finals and they end up losing as well. But that's a Cavs team that, with Mo Williams as probably the second best player on that team, had a very good chance of winning the title. Then it was all taken away, and then the decision, and then, you know, him and LeBron had a falling out, and then they kind of came back together, you know, with this Cleveland thing. So yeah, I like Mo as a choice as well, but I'm still going to go Jefferson. But Channing Frye, I don't think any of us are going to pick because he's not old enough yet.
Yeah,
got to earn a few more stripes there, kid.
So the block, we got to talk about the block. Because not only is it among the pantheon of great Finals, you know, game saving moments or game winning moments, it also fits among like the transcendent athletic plays in Finals history. It belongs in both things, which is, you know, almost unprecedented, because all the rest of those things are either one or the other, but not both. You know, and for me, yeah, you know, obviously there's Jordan's steal and shot in 1998. There's Magic's baby hook in 1987. The John Paxson and Steve Kerr jumpers in 93 and 97, both off of passes from Jordan, I believe. George King, game-saving steal for the Nationals off of Andy Phillip in 1955. We talked about that in our Game 7 podcast before. And Vinnie Johnson jumper in a 1994, the Pistons, to seal off their second championship. And, you know, the transcendent athletic plays in Finals history is the one that we see over and over again. Dr. J's circus shot around the backboard against the Lakers in 1980, Game 4. Jordan's hand-switching layup in 91, Game 2, also against the Lakers. And then one I'd forgotten about, but it's another staple of highlight plays, the Larry Bird following the miss with the rebound, switching his hands and flipping the shot around the backboard. That was 1981. And then Jerry Wiss, 60-foot game tying shot against the Knicks in 1970, although in overtime the Knicks won that series, but or the game, and then would win the series. So, you know, when you're talking about that level of thing, I feel like it is just totally right there. And there's that extra irony that I love, that he got it against Iguodala, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That makes it so much more important, I think.
Right. Who was the guy who defended him, you know, really effectively last year and won the MVP. And then, you know, to get the guy and to win the series. And I mean, he was already Finals MVP, but to just get punctuated by beating him. And I think Iguodala's great. So I just thought it was incredible. And there's also, you know, not just that, but also the key moments of Kyrie hitting the three-pointer right in front of Curry, and then of being able to, you know, malign for his defense, obviously, but able to, he got the switch on Curry, and then Curry was trying to, you know, get around him to just get a three-point shot off, and Love just, you know, stuck with it and defended him really well, and was able to prevent him from getting any kind of good shot. And, you know, those were, you know, the kind of the three key plays down the stretch that that sealed the game for the Cavs.
I think one of the important parts that I love about this LeBron play, and why I think the block is one of the, or probably would be my favorite Finals play or big Finals play ever, would be the fact that a lot of the other ones that you mentioned, a lot of the other big ones, are all kind of smart basketball plays, solid basketball plays. You know, Jordan with the steal, that's nice, and then he hits the shot, and, you know, Magic's hook, and like these other things. Whereas this one was just the perfect encapsulation of a LeBron James, because it's just like the burst of athleticism like we've never seen before. The guy's put his hand is above, you know, the square on the backboard, to chase this guy down, where there's an image, I don't know if you saw it, where Iguodala's at the free throw line and LeBron's at the 3-point line. And if I showed you that picture and said, yeah, by the way, this guy blocks that guy, you would be stunned by that. And it's Andre Iguodala, who's a very athletic guy himself in his own right. Of course, you know, he's hampered by a little bit of back injuries as well. But I think that part of it just adds so much, because it's such a perfect LeBron moment, that it's just this burst of just unbelievable athleticism that saves the series and wins his team the game. And that's, there's just so much in that and so much extra that's put on there. Like you said, again, also with it being Iguodala, who stopped him last year, who helped, you know, stop him last year and won the MVP. And now LeBron sort of taking the MVP away from him, winning a championship for Cleveland, you know, showing this unbelievable stuff. I mean, there's just so much into that one play. And just like, it was one that you just had to keep seeing and seeing on replays. And you saw a different thing every time you saw it. It was like, oh my God, he did this, or oh my God, I can't believe he came from there. So I think there's just so much in that play to love and really adore as an all-time great moment.
So as far as best performances in a finals game go, LeBron with his game 5 and game 6 had two of the top three game scorers in a finals game since 1984. That's as far as the stat goes back, according to basketballreference.com. Game 5 was a 39.2 game score, the third best ever, 41.16 rebounds, 7 assists, 3 steals, and 3 blocks. Game 42.5 game score, number one number, 41.8 rebounds, 11 assists, 4 steals, and 3 blocks. So, not bad. The second greatest, Tim Duncan, game 1 of 2003 series, 32 points, 20 rebounds, 7 blocks. Jordan, his 55-point game in 93, 55 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists. Number 5 was Shaq in 2000, 43 points, 19 rebounds. Number 6, Charles Barkley. Barkley actually had, I think he had number 6 and number 9 on this list. Pretty impressive for being only in one finals. In 93, 42 points, 13 rebounds, 4 assists. And as we mentioned before, Draymond's game 7 among the top here was the 8th best game score ever and the best ever in a game 7. So, so those top performances and LeBron having number 1 and number 3, obviously very impressive. The players with the most game scores above 30, Jordan has 8, Shaq has 8, LeBron has 5, Magic had 5, Wade had 4, Bird and Worthy had 3. Worthy kind of a surprise on that list. Duncan and Barkley had 2, and then other guys are Kobe, Clyde Drexler, Draymond, Kyrie, Iverson, Dennis Johnson, Rashard Lewis, Karl Malone.
Lewis. Welcome.
Isaiah and Russell Westbrook. So pretty impressive list there. If you look at some of the greatest finals games of all time, there may be others that it's hard to kind of find a definitive list of this. So if I miss your favorite, I apologize, but just some of the best ones, some of the best ones from before 84. Magic Johnson's game 6 in 1980, 42 points, 15 rebounds, 7 assists, and 3 steals. Walt Frazier in game 7 in 1970, 36 points, 19 assists, 7 rebounds. Elgin Baylor, game 5 in 62, 61 points and 22 rebounds. So that's the most points ever in a finals game. Bill Russell in game 7 of that 62 series, 30 points and 40 rebounds. Not too bad. Bob Pettit in 58, game six, which is the deciding game, first player to score 50 points in a series, and only Pettit, Baylor, Jordan, Rick Barry, and Jerry West have scored 50 or more in a finals game. Bill Walton in 1977, game 6, 20 points, 23 rebounds, 7 assists, and 8 blocks. And then Jerry West, game 7, 1969, 42 points, 13 rebounds, 12 assists in a losing effort, giving him the finals MVP, famously the first finals MVP and the only player to get it in a losing effort. So, and as we mentioned, only LeBron, West, and Worthy have had triple-doubles in a Game 7, and LeBron's triple-double was the 22nd NBA Finals triple-double of all time. He has 7 in his career, and the next closest is Magic with 6. So that is that's not too bad. Not a lot of if Magic and LeBron have 13 of them, that is not going to leave too many for other players.
No, not at all.
So some of the greatest teams to never win a title, of course, the Warriors are now on that list. The only team with a higher SRS, which is Basketball Reference's it's sort of their like point differential plus strength of schedule margin to just sort of, you know, a better job of measuring a team's greatness other than wins and losses. The 72 Bucks had the fourth best all time SRS, but they the only reason they lost the scale, they lost to the 72 Lakers, who had a slightly better SRS and were a 69 win team. So the Warriors had a 10. The Warriors had a 10.38 SRS, which was sixth all time. And the Spurs had a 10.28 SRS, seventh of all time. They, of course, did not win either. They lost to the Thunder in the playoffs. So that's two teams among the seven best SRS teams in history that lost in the same playoffs. That did not win the championship. So that's certainly quite a thing. 11 out of the top 27 SRS NBA teams did not win championships. 16 of them did. Four of those were I would consider major upsets, and the two that I just mentioned happened in this postseason. So this is a really historical postseason for that reason. So as far as where this kind of rates among the finals upsets, the Cavs were 57-25 with a 5.45 SRS, which is fourth in the league. The Warriors, of course, 73 wins, a 10.38 SRS. So that's by far the biggest differential when it comes to an upset. I think the two that are the closest in terms of the in terms of this upset, something that you could look at in history, the 2011 Mavs beating the Heat, but that was actually fairly close and only a one win differential between the two teams. 2006, the Heat beating the Mavs, a little bit more of an upset. It was an 8-win differential. Actually, even though the 2004 Pistons is considered an upset, the Pistons actually had a better SRS than the Lakers did that season. The Lakers not quite at full strength through most of that season because of Karl Malone's injury, so you could argue that wasn't the best measure. But But some of the better ones are the 95 Rockets, who had a 2.32 SRS and had 10 fewer wins than the 57-win Magic, who had a 6.44 SRS. And the Rockets famously beat three teams with close to 60 wins or more during that playoff run before they got to the Magic. So,
yeah, and we've talked about that team as well pretty extensively, of like a team that in the first half was like, you know, dead to rights, had nothing, and then just turned it on in the last half. So their record probably doesn't match up with their talent level, but still, yeah, to go through the gauntlet they went through to eventually win the title is certainly definitely worth noting and probably right up there as a great upset.
The 75 Warriors, who were a 48 win team, they had a 2.86 SRS, which is fourth in the league, and then they beat the Bullets, who had 60 wins and a 6.53 SRS. So that's a
yeah, that might be number one.
That's pretty strong. And it's funny because the Warriors actually are a pretty similar team in some respects to this Cavs team. They were centered around Rick Barry, who was their star. He was like sort of a dominant wing player, you know, who was a great passer. And he had come back to the Warriors after leaving for the NBA and obviously angering a lot of the home fans. And when he came back, they were very happy. And although he was not as well liked as LeBron, obviously, in many respects, even though there are a lot of people who don't like LeBron, he also carried a very young team that was not expected to do a whole lot to win a championship. Even though expectations were pretty high for the Cavs, I feel like the Warriors dynasty, the Warriors looking like they were going to become a dynasty, you know, kind of seemed like it was going to close that window, which of course makes the Cavs accomplishment even that much more impressive. So the other ones, the 74 Celtics, who had 56 wins, but a much worse SRS, 3.42, beat the Bucks, who had 59 wins and almost double the SRS. The other one that from 58, the Hawks, who had a 0.82 SRS, beat the Celtics, who had a 5.01 SRS. So that was a pretty big upset. The first loss in Bill Russell's career, although he would do pretty well by winning the next eight. So
So
the Cleveland sports curse, that of course broke the 52-year Cleveland sports curse, finally winning a championship since 64. And you found out how many cities have won a championship in the four major sports since then.
Yes, there are a total of 36 cities I found, and I think I got them all. Someone will probably correct me if I did get them wrong, but I will list them now here for you. You can double-check me on the numbers, but you have St. Louis, Los Angeles, Baltimore, Detroit, New York, Pittsburgh, Oakland, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Kansas City, Minnesota, Toronto, Atlanta, Miami, Phoenix, Anaheim. I guess you could call it Anaheim with Los Angeles, but we're going to count them separate for the purposes of this. Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, Green Bay, Dallas, Washington, D.C., Denver, Tampa Bay, Indianapolis, New Orleans, Seattle, Milwaukee, Portland, Houston, San Antonio, Montreal, Edmonton, Calgary, East Rutherford / Newark, and then also Raleigh, North Carolina. So, of course, the last two are the last four, five, you could probably assume, are from the NHL, of course. But Raleigh, North Carolina, not well known for their sports franchise, but still, yeah, they all won titles before old Cleveland did.
There you go. So the Cavs have now moved on to the list of 19 teams that have, or I'm excuse me, 20 teams that have won championships in either the NBA or the ABA. The teams that have not won championships are the Hornets, the Nuggets, the Clippers, the Grizzlies, the Timberwolves, the Pelicans, the Magic, the Suns, the Raptors, and the Jazz. The Hawks, the Nets, the Thunder, and the Kings have all have championships in their franchises, but not in their current city. And the Pacers, Bucks, Knicks, 76ers, Blazers, and Wizards have not won a championship in the past 30 years. So the 10 franchises that anyone under the age of 40 actually remembers winning a title are now the Cavs, the Celtics, the Bulls, the Mavericks, the Pistons, the Warriors, the Rockets, the Lakers, the Heat, and the Spurs. So, and under, if you want to say under 30, the Rockets are, I guess probably under 25. The Rockets and the Bulls are coming very close to being knocked off that list, which is pretty incredible to think about. But
that's very sad. Well, to think about. So thank you for making me now also get older, Rich. So that's fine.
It's an inevitability of time. Yeah. But and of course the Warriors and the Cavs have been added to that recent champions list. And the Cavs joining that list. So it's really hard to win a championship, I guess, is the point of that. And anyone listening to this probably knows that, but it's still it's a remarkable achievement. It was a great Game 7 and just a really fun to think about and to talk about and to explore. And so I'm glad we got a chance to take a longer hiatus, but we decided we had to come back and talk about this. And now we're going to take a break for a few weeks, get ready for our summer Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s series, which I think hopefully people are excited to hear. And it's going to be fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. So back definitely in the summer. It's going to be an awesome, awesome series. We got some pretty cool guests already lined up or ones that we're sort of working with. So I think it's going to be spectacular. I know people loved last year's, top 50 player, top 50 of all time, ranking and re-ranking, all that sort of stuff, and the 50 greatest thing. That was awesome. But I really do think this one, now that we're sort of sinking our teeth into doing the research and stuff, it's really, really going to be a lot of fun. And I think everyone's going to enjoy it as well.
Yeah. I hope so. So we should be sometime early July. We should be starting that one out. We're going to let free agency kind of play out for a little bit and the draft, of course, and then come back at you once you've had all your free agency fill. Once you need a little NBA history to get you through the rest of the summer, we're going to be here for you for that. So hopefully that works out well. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Over and back NBA for both. Please, we're on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to leave a rating and review, we would greatly appreciate that. A good one, we would prefer. And I don't know, Rich, is there anything else? HarvardProxies.com. Go there and find us. We both have been writing there a little bit, so you can find we've been writing about NBA history, and of course, our podcasts are posted there. So yeah.
That's it. I think you got it.
Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. We'll be back again soon.